record-breaking visits to Jacksonville are good news for the local economy. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now, video on demand, with our partners TVJax.com. And just ahead, the CEO of Visit Jacksonville takes your calls about growing tourism here on the First Coast. Get on the line now and join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, a moving performance at the Symphony this week commemorating the songs of the Holocaust. We'll tell you about it. Plus, the signs and symptoms of stroke. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, tourism in Jacksonville is a $2.2 billion industry that employs thousands of people in our area. And here's the good news. The past 2 years have been record-breaking for visitors coming here to check out the First Coast. That's revenue, giving the city plenty to celebrate. In fact, the celebrations are happening all this week as Jacksonville marks National Travel and Tourism Week with a series of events highlighting tourism's growing importance to our local economy. We're pleased to welcome Visit Jacksonville CEO Paul Asselford. He joins us now in studio with more about the numbers and why tourism matters for this area. Good to see you. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Melissa.
And what are your thoughts about tourism growing here in our area? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email or tweet the show. We're already getting your comments on our Facebook page. This is great news because, you know, you think of Florida as a state built on a tourism economy, but that tends to be more South and Central Florida. When you came here to Jacksonville, it was your mission to really grow North Florida as a tourism destination. And it sounds as though those efforts are starting to pay off.
Well, thank goodness they are. I will say that from an economic development standpoint, tourism is a growing picture for our community. And bottom line, you're looking at tourism in any community, and it's very competitive for those tourism dollars, but you're looking to truly have tourism create a greater prosperity for the community and a better quality of life for all the people who live here. So, yeah, we're pretty happy with where it's going right now.
More than $2 billion in sales and dollars coming into this community, you've measured, simply due to tourism. When people come to North Florida, what are they most interested in seeing? Where are the dollars going?
Actually, they're spread out, because of our diversity, spread out into a lot of different things. When you talk about this natural water wonderland that we have, that is a great attraction. Even with the growing European eco-tourism, that puts us in a pretty nice place as far as positioning Jacksonville internationally, which we had not been previously. But even beyond that, Jacksonville with the beaches, Jacksonville with the events that we have, the sporting orientation of our community, all of these things attract people here. And the arts and cultural scene in Jacksonville is very special. My wife's a fine artist, and when we moved here, in fact, when we came here and saw it for the first time, she was very surprised with the arts and cultural scene in Jacksonville. So all those things are attractions.
And call us up right now to connect with Visit Jacksonville CEO Paul Asselford as the city marks Travel and Tourism Week. We'll tell you all about the events taking place in a moment. The number to join us, 549-2937. Now, you said that when your wife came here, she was pleasantly surprised. I think a lot of people have that reaction in the sense that there is a lot happening here, but Jacksonville, as compared to, say, South Beach, Miami, or Orlando, is still not as big a name around the world in terms of what we have to offer. What are some of the challenges you see as CEO of Visit Jackson growing our reputation internationally? And also, what about people that kind of like the fact that Jacksonville is still a little bit under the radar? They think that maybe leads to a better quality of life.
Well, when you're looking at what I'll call the 21st century global marketplace, those folks who are trying to maintain the status quo are the folks that are going to essentially keep Jacksonville from entering into the 21st century global marketplace. And there is no status quo. You are either going down or you're going up.
Right.
And those communities that understand that are, among other things, encouraging the tourism market, because that's money that people locally don't have to pay to keep the community upkeep.
When you first came to Jacksonville, you caused a lot of discussion as a newcomer to the community, observing that you see a lot of different organizations and individuals were working in silos, not all on the same page about how to grow prosperity and quality of life and business and a host of things in this city. Do you still feel that way? What are the biggest challenges you see in Jacksonville?
Well, I will say one of the most encouraging things that I see in Jacksonville is we're going through a transformation right now. And that transformation has to do with a much more collaborative, visionary approach to the future of our community. And I'm watching the silos disappear. There's lots of discussion about what the priorities really should be for our community and how what those priorities are set the foundation for a growing prosperity within the community. And I'm not just talking about more cars on the road here. I'm talking about planning the future so that the foot traffic, for example, in the downtown becomes much more significant and allows our downtown to emerge. But at the same time, encouraging all of the parts of our destination to be participating together. I'll tell you, Visit Florida is looking at Northeast Florida right now as an emphasis for a reemergence of new visitors, because the visitor industry is changing and people are looking for something different than the typical, what I'll call entertainment destinations. They're looking for adventure and experience that's different from what they had been looking for in the past.
You recently differed with Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry, telling the website Florida Politics that, in your opinion, one obstacle holding tourism back to this city is our failure to update the human rights ordinance to cover LGBT residents and visitors. Can you explain a little bit why you feel that way?
Well, I'm talking really about the future, because the human rights ordinance has not, from Jacksonville, has not hit the national scene as it has in other cities. But it's been very clear that cities that are not open and inviting to all people, it's become very obvious that those cities are being pushed aside. They're not even being considered by what I'll call the meeting professionals of the world, the people who plan conventions. They are actually not even considering communities today that do not have an open LGBT HRO ordinances that essentially demonstrate that it's an inviting community. So when you're looking at the world in general, and a lot of people are going to jump on me for this, but when you're looking at setting certain people aside or making rules to not be inviting, essentially, the bottom line is it's, in principle, no different than ISIS. When you're looking at a religion that says, if you don't do it my way, we'll kill you. The principle is they believe something and they won't allow anyone else to believe different than them. So it's a wake up. When you talk about tourism and you talk about cultures meeting, tourism becomes something much more than a economic development engine for a community or the world. Tourism is about bringing the world together, introducing, inviting people from all over the world to become familiar with each other and what those differences might be, but to respect those differences at the same time.
Are we losing business now?
We're not yet. Unless it becomes a national issue about Jacksonville, for the moment, we're not losing business. But there's been enough what I'll call media coverage that it's a concern. And even at the Professional Convention Management Association annual convention, which was in Vancouver, meeting professionals came up to me and said, "Where's this going? Houston almost lost the Super Bowl because essentially the NFL said, we're not considering cities that are not open and inviting and have that open HRO. And therefore, this tendency is spreading around the country. And that openness is going to be important to the future of our community.
And right now, let's go to your calls for the CEO of Visit Jacksonville, Paul Asselford. It's National Travel and Tourism Week. What are your thoughts about Jacksonville making new records, setting new records in its tourism numbers? 549-2937. Albie in St. Augustine. Albie, how are you? Good morning.
Oh, excellent. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Yes. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Just more of a comment and quick question. Now, I grew up, and I'm going to draw two parallels. I grew up in Orlando and then lived most of my life in Hawaii, two big tourist destinations. And as long as the, you know, I see it as a positive thing. The one side, as long as the development is also, the investment is put into infrastructure, because I see in Orlando and Hawaii that you have this huge swell, this increase of money in tourism, but then you push out a lot of the lower income, the people that work at the hospitality industry. A lot of those people get pushed out to the fringes as development keeps going, growing without any infrastructure. And you can look at Orlando and it's some of the worst traffic in the country, or Hawaii where, you know, it's almost at unsustainable the amount of people that ended up going there for tourism and staying. So I guess the question is, how do you balance, which is a good thing, the tourism brings the income, but how do you balance that with increasing or making sure your infrastructure is supporting all of this growth?
Sure.
And I can take my comments off here.
Right. There are those that don't want to see any more tourism, mm-hmm. or at least control the growth of it. What about his point?
The point's a good one, and it really has to do with a community's ability to plan in advance. When you're talking about traffic, when you're talking about new restaurants and attractions and everything building up, where are the appropriate places to put that? And what is the traffic pattern that is going to emerge? Those are the kind of things that need planning, and without planning, it just evolves.
And do you feel that Visit Jax is working in concert well with, for example, the regional planning organization, the city? You feel like everyone is getting on the same page about this?
I really do. I will tell you that Visit Jacksonville has what we call an aspirational plan that really deals also with not just building the tourism industry, but it talks about infrastructure and what is needed and wayfinding and things of that nature. Those are things that have to be taken into consideration, or you end up with masses that are not well planned for.
549-2937 to join us. Tiny, is that your name? Tiny in Jacksonville, or excuse me, Atlantic Beach.
It's Jeannie, actually.
Jeannie. Hi.
I just wanted to make a statement that I completely agree with your guest about the HRO ordinance and its economic impact on our community. If we look to what's been going on in North Carolina and everything, it's only a matter of time before people start to really investigate cities like ours that offer so many things and yet restrict us in, you know, human rights ways. And I think it's going to negatively impact our city if we don't start moving in that direction.
Tini, thanks for the call. North Carolina is seeing a pretty big economic backlash right now after the governor there passed an ordinance, well, or a law through the legislature that LGBT advocates see as regressive.
Yes, and when you're talking about what it does to a community, it's not just, as in our case, having conventioners not want to come here or whatever. It really has to do with businesses. The business world is creating a message for our communities, and it is saying, if you want to be progressive, if you want to truly create prosperity for your community and the jobs that come with it, you have to take these things into consideration or we will not consider you.
Will you keep bringing this up with city officials, with the mayor's office, in your capacity as the CEO of tourism in our area?
It'll be an automatic message. It's not one where I'm out pounding the streets right now, but it's one where we're involved with conversations with the right leaders of the community, at least letting them know what the consequences may be for Jacksonville in the future.
Tom is on the west side. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Yes, good morning. I'm wonderful. How about yourself?
Doing great.
Outstanding. My concerns here are on planning, coordination, and prioritization. I mean, I've lived in Jacksonville a while, and I remember the failure of the Save the Sarah effort. We've been talking about a downtown aquarium for, seems like forever, and there's still the ongoing discussions about bringing the Adams here. And so far, it's like all these things have only gotten to the discussion stage, and then we're at the same time are handicapping ourselves by spending so much of the tourist development money to improve the stadium.
Okay. Tom, thanks for that.
Well, you just put on the table an important issue. The tourism development tax, the hotel tax that is dedicated to the upkeep and the bonds for the athletic facilities here in our community, that makes the tourism, the dollars, the bed taxes, even more important than they have ever been before. Because without those, and you're talking about the big picture of the financial circumstances surrounding Jacksonville in general with the pension fund and all that Mayor Curry has dedicated his time to, which thankfully he is doing. But it comes back to where is Jacksonville financially? And therefore, what can we afford to put on the plan, the building plan for our future? And one of those issues comes back to what we started the conversation with, and that is, where are the sources of income? And tourism is a big source of that income.
Jerry in Jacksonville. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Okay, go ahead.
Good. I have a question for the guests. So apart from the big dollar things like an aquarium and the things that are happening with the stadium and bringing in a Navy ship, I go to other cities like Austin, Texas. Their river is just exploding with people on kayaks. And you go to other cities that are on the Mississippi River or Miami, there are sailboats. There's all kinds of things happening in the water, parasailing on the ocean. And not an insult to Jacksonville, but those things have been going on for 40, 50 years. It's nothing new. So why are we so far behind on that? Are there roadblocks? Is the government resisting licensing or permitting?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that many have brought up. Now, you mentioned efforts, Shad Khan's efforts to develop the shipyards. He mentioned the effort to bring the Navy ship to the riverbank as a museum. There are things happening, but he's right in that our riverfront is seen by many people, and I think you would agree, Paul, as not meeting its full potential.
There's no question about it. It's something that our tourism industry has been involved with the discussions long before I got here. That is an issue that is part of what I'll call the overall infrastructure development plan for our community. And the opportunity is incredible on what we could be showcasing Jacksonville with. And part of what we also have to look at is how you create this foot traffic for a community like Jacksonville so that it starts to allow businesses to emerge in the community. And one of those issues, and we haven't touched on it right now, is the convention center. Convention center that we have currently isn't serving the purpose.
And here's a comment about that on our Facebook page from John. We need a new convention center. The Prime Osborne is horribly undersized for a city as large as ours. We're missing out on hundreds of millions of dollars. The chamber says it affects business recruitment, and it's the key to downtown development. Convention tourism will attract other businesses. We've been hearing this complaint for how many years now? And there's no plan that I know of to find the funding to get a new convention center. Of course, the mayor will tell you we can't do any of these initiatives until we resolve the city's pension debt crisis.
Yes. And I will tell you that there is a study that is being done by the Strategic Advisory Group, a consultant, about the whole issue that is now on the table and what a convention center can bring to our community, what it will mean to the future. And it talks a little bit about, it's not released yet, it's still in the production stage, but it does talk a bit about how you fund this kind of
where are we going to get the money? Because I think people, we've seen so many studies over the years in this city about so many different issues, and do you think that there's maybe a tendency to study an issue to death rather than just take action to bring about the results that we want? I've lived here since 2003, and I can't count the number of blue ribbon panels, commissions, studies, white papers, task forces, and yet we keep seeing the same problems, and this is one of them.
It is an example of what existed previously. You mentioned the silo-driven projects. Well, part of the reason that we as a community don't have a convention center in spite of what it would bring to our community is that from a developer standpoint, that might not be putting the money in the right pockets. And so it's an issue of the community going through the transformation that it currently is in, really looking at what those priorities need to be rather than individual projects.
Let's take one more call for Visit Jack CEO Paul Asselford. Karen in San Marco. Go ahead, Karen.
Yes, I wanted to talk about the river. I've lived in Jacksonville most of my life, growing up in Atlantic Beach. And, of course, the beach was a really big part of my life. But then my husband and I recently discovered, I guess in the last 5 years, how much fun the river was in terms of kayaking. One of the questions, now we also dragon boat on the river in the Intercoastal Waterway. And I know we have out-of-town people who come in who are members of other dragon boat teams, and they just go to meetup.com. See that we have a team, paddle when they're here in town working. My question is, in terms of kayaking, I know there are sites out there when you come to Northeast Florida that says, you know, you can rent a kayak here or here. My question is, does the website or anything that we have out there in terms of a website connect to Jacksonville's park systems with all the 60-plus places that you can put in a kayak or another,
you
know, a motorized vehicle?
Sure. Okay, Karen, thanks for that question. That gets back to your earlier point about this city being an ecotourism hub.
Yes. When you talk about not just the river, but what the river leads to in this community, the experiences on the water are incredible. My wife and I kayaking just to do bird watching. And the feeling that it gives, and I have to tell you, I love the peace and tranquility that it embeds in me. I need that once in a while. Mm-hmm. But yes, the water is something this community should definitely be taking better advantage of.
You're going to have a series of events this week to mark Travel and Tourism Week. Speaking of the water, on Friday, there will be a beach cleanup at the Jacksonville Beach Pier. First Wednesday Art Walk will team up with Visit Jax for that monthly event. And then today, it's Rally in Red. You're wearing red, Paul, to demonstrate travel's impact on our local economy. Lots happening. What else is going on this week to mark this?
Well, we also have the Thursday Thank You Day, and that is where we're going out and actually finding the visitors that are in our community and embracing them.
Oh, very nice.
Telling them how much we appreciate them being here and that we hope they'll be back many more times in the future.
Well, thanks for sharing the good news this morning, and enjoy the week. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Paul Asselford, the CEO of Visit Jacksonville, in studio with us. And later, the signs and symptoms of stroke and how to stay healthy this National Stroke Awareness Month. But up next, an emotionally impactful tribute at the Symphony marking the Holocaust. We'll tell you about it. That's in a moment.
For kids whose parents are undocumented, it's more than just paperwork.
And that's when I realized that things were really, really unstable. And the part of the reason why they were fighting so much was because of this one thing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. You've seen Diane Guerrero on Orange is the New Black. Hear her story next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Genesis Morales lives in Texas. She's the daughter of Mexican immigrants.
My mom always explained to me that if she had the opportunity to go to college and get a better job so she doesn't have to be working in a factory all night long, she would.
She'd always worked hard in school, but it all came down to one thing her junior year.
All of our hard work was put down in a number.
Next time on Reveal, what's in store for students of color in the Lone Star State?
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
The number of heroin-related deaths on the First Coast has more than doubled in a year. Law enforcement is pledging to clamp down on sellers as they urge users to seek help for their powerful addiction. In Community Thread, The Opioid Epidemic, we'll take a look at the factors drawing people toward the needle and the strategies our community is using to fight back. Log on to wjct.org/events/community-thread to submit your questions or to RSVP to be a part of our studio audience on May 10th.
Welcome back. Well, it's a unique and somber way of commemorating the horrors of the Holocaust and the incredible human spirit that survived. Donald McCullough, a resident of Atlantic Beach and director of the Jacksonville Symphony Chorus, spent a whole year researching the songs and stories that recounted life in Nazi concentration camps. The result? The Holocaust Cantata, Songs from the Camps. This really impactful work will be performed tomorrow night at the Jacksonville Symphony. We have a preview right now as we welcome Donald McCullough to the studio, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And it's my understanding that this work has been presented all around the world hundreds of times. It's such an honor for it to be done here in Jacksonville. So first of all, kudos.
Thank you. Thanks. It's exciting to do it.
And how did this all begin for you, this research project?
I was living in D.C. at the time, and I've always had this fascination with music that was created out of human experience, what you might call folk music. But so I wonder if there was something similar that happened in the Nazi concentration camps. Not that it has time to evolve like folk music does from generation to generation, but something that would speak to daily life, the emotions of people, what things were like, just the human condition expressed through music created by the people who you're experiencing it can be really powerful. So I went to the museum and asked if they had any such thing and found out there's a whole floor of archive there and off-site archives. And so I went through that collection, and that's where I found these songs.
People might not realize that incredible music was composed and performed by imprisoned Jews and others in these camps, and so much of it has survived, which is so extraordinary.
Yeah, well, and a lot of that, you know, is there was the Terezin, which was kind of used as for propaganda purposes. They let the USO in there and see all these happy people performing in orchestras and whatnot. And they were given some, you know, liberty in terms of being able to perform and write music. These were classically trained composers. What you would hear tomorrow night is more music of the people. These were, I would say, some of them, they had training, but I wouldn't call them classical. So these songs are more, you know, just music of the time.
Sure.
As opposed to what I would say timeless classical.
And we have a small excerpt of Holocaust Cantata, Songs from the Camps. Let's listen. And that's called We Remember Them. Can you tell us about that piece?
That is actually the very last thing on the performance tomorrow night. And it's a prayer, really. It's a way to respond to what you've heard for the whole evening. And because the act of remembrance is a powerful one, which is why we are doing this on Yom HaShoah, the Day of Holocaust Remembrance. And so it's a beautiful text. You know, we remember them in the rustling of the leaves. It goes through all of the seasons, the times in which, all of the things that allow us to kind of recall things that are important in our lives.
How do you see music, and it's also readings in this performance,
right,
in doing this important work of continuing to educate new generations about the Holocaust?
Well, I think what's important is a lot of people learn about the Holocaust in these huge numbers. There were, you know, 6 million Jews murdered. There were 3 million Polish people. There were, you know, gypsies, homosexuals, Slavs, handicapped. All of these numbers are huge. So you can't, you hear that and you think it's horrific. What the music allows you to do is you experience real life stories in this particular, and I think that's the power of the music that's contained in the cantata, is there's no storyline in it or anything like that. They're really what I call snapshots in time, where you are just almost eavesdropping on someone's innermost experience and feelings about where they are in the moment. And there's power in hearing small individual stories that are a tiny fraction of the millions that were murdered. Mm-hmm. But encountering it face-to-face like that, I think, is quite different and very powerful, and makes it a personal experience for you rather than something that's intellectually understood in such huge numbers.
It's such a powerful work. And again, my kudos to you for this accomplishment, one of many in your musical career.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us, Donald McCullough. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Donald McCullough is director of the Jacksonville Symphony Chorus, and his Holocaust Cantata, Songs from the Camps, will be performed tomorrow night, Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. at the Times Union Center. Tickets at jacksymphony.org. We will go to break with another piece from this work. It's called I Will Lift Up Mine Eyes. We'll be right back.
Know what's for dinner tonight? Turns out most of us don't, even late in the day. That's one reason the fast casual dining boom shows no sign of slowing down. And now that's being supplemented by other choices, like home-delivered meal kits.
We like to cook, but we found it expensive, we found it difficult to assemble ingredients, and we found it inaccessible.
That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Give mom the perfect gift for Mother's Day, a ticket to Girls Day Out, a day just for her to refresh, rejuvenate, and celebrate good health and wellness. September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel, the day begins with breakfast, followed by exciting speakers that will engage and empower, a great lunch, swag bag, and much more. Tickets are $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout and get your tickets today.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, since 2005, nearly 800 reporters have been killed while doing their work. Veteran journalist Dana Priest on the risks reporters face around the world and international efforts to boost press safety and freedoms.
At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back to the show. Well, it strikes more than 800,000 Americans each year, often without warning. But thanks to better diagnosis and awareness in recent years, stroke has dropped to the fifth leading cause of death in this country. But stroke is still the leading cause of disability. With that, we want to stress that May is National Stroke Awareness Month. Here with more about signs and symptoms of stroke, as well as some groundbreaking local research, we welcome Dr. David Miller, director of the Mayo Clinic Stroke Center in Jacksonville. Doctor, good to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being with us. I guess the good news is, thanks to efforts like yours and many other physicians and medical professionals, people are getting more aware about stroke, the signs and symptoms of stroke. Is that correct?
It is, and it's actually extremely important. You know, everybody knows the signs and symptoms of heart attack. If somebody's having chest pain, if somebody gets short of breath, if somebody's, you know, these are things that people equate with heart disease and heart attack. The same thing with stroke is a lot of people don't understand the signs and symptoms and therefore don't make the connection.
And we're going to put an acronym out to our listeners right now. This comes from the American Heart Association. It's called How to Spot a Stroke Fast, FAST. Face drooping for F, arm weakness, speech difficulty, T for time to call 911. And time is everything, isn't it? When you think someone might be in the throes of a stroke, the sooner the better you get them to help. It's so important.
It actually is. Over the last several years, we've developed a lot of new treatments for stroke, acute stroke, and they have been very effective. That's one of the reasons that the death rate has been dropping. But unfortunately, there's a limited time window to get patients to help, and therefore time becomes a very important thing whenever you think someone may be having a stroke.
Tell us a little bit about the research at Mayo Clinic Stroke Center, because I know there have been some important advancements.
Yes, we've been part of a number of studies into stroke, but perhaps the most significant one came out of a group in Amsterdam. But this is stuff that we've been doing for years. There's actually ways in which we can take patients who have an occlusion in the arteries in the brain, and we can actually go up with small catheters, which are tubes about the size of a piece of spaghetti, and we can get a hold of the clot and pull it out. And in those cases, we can oftentimes reverse the effects of an acute stroke.
Wow, that's encouraging. Now, I know you also want to talk a little bit about your collaboration with the American Heart Association. Blood pressure, high blood pressure, is the single most important risk factor and the number one cause of stroke. How are you working with Heart Association to get the word out about bringing down our blood pressure?
We are actually very excited about the collaboration with the Heart Association. They've been, on the forefront of this for years, and they do a great job. I think perhaps the emphasis on blood pressure is important because it's known as the, quote, silent killer. Because the truth is that you can have very high blood pressure, very abnormal blood pressure, and not know it. It doesn't affect you necessarily until you have a stroke or you have another major event. So the truth is you really need to check your blood pressure. I always say if you don't know your numbers, you don't know. because it's very important. You don't have to have your blood pressure checked every day or every week, but once a year or every 2 years, you should have a medical professional check your blood pressure. If you don't have a doctor, if you don't have a medical professional that you can go to, you can go to any one of the pharmacies and actually some stores. It's very easy these days to get your blood pressure checked.
Yeah, you can go into a drugstore and sit down at that little chair device thing and stick your arm in and get the number.
Exactly. Now, sometimes that number may be good or bad. The thing is that one blood pressure reading doesn't necessarily mean that you have a problem. And if you have a problem, it doesn't mean that there's nothing that can be done. But if it comes up abnormal or if it's something to worry about or if you have a family history of that, you really need to find somebody and talk to them about it.
Who's most at risk? And obviously, we talk about these common sense pieces of advice whenever we talk about stroke awareness. People need to quit smoking, eat a healthy diet, get some exercise. I know you tell this to all your patients, but are there some that are at higher risk than others?
Yes, there are. And the African-American community is at particular risk because of the higher rates of blood pressure, of high blood pressure and of diabetes. But anyone can be at risk, and those are the reasons that you need to get regular checkups and make sure that you address these things. Again, people who have family histories, if you have uncles, if you have aunts, if you have brothers and sisters that have these kinds of problems, there's a little bit more likelihood that you may have them as well. And the truth is, these days there are lots of treatments that really don't change your lifestyle too much. Certainly, eating better, quitting smoking, there are some things that are important to do, and they're not as hard to do, perhaps, as we think. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be a marathon runner. You don't have to be somebody who spends 10 hours a day doing exercise to get the benefits. Really, 20 minutes a day can make a huge difference.
Great advice, as always. Doctor, thanks for being with us to talk about Stroke Awareness Month. We appreciate it.
Again, thanks for having me.
He's Dr. David Miller, director of the Mayo Clinic Stroke Center in Jacksonville. Again, May is National Stroke Awareness Month. Get your blood pressure checked. Follow that advice and reduce your risk. We'll be right back.
Spend some time in the square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT invites you to vote for your favorite submission. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about the square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
For kids whose parents are undocumented, it's more than just paperwork.
And that's when I realized that things were really, really unstable. And part of the reason why they were fighting so much was because of this one thing.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. You've seen Diane Guerrero on Orange is the New Black. Hear her story next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's Public Service Recognition Week in America, a time set aside to honor our nation's public servants. Now, they come in all walks of life. That includes those from the nonprofit sector and those who work at protecting the environment. Here with more, we welcome Sarah Boren of the local chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Neil Armanjian, Matanzas Riverkeeper. Good to see you.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
And you were just here, so it's good to have you back again.
Yes, thank you.
Let's talk about this, because when you think about Public Service Week, you think of government workers, but public service extends beyond that. Nonprofit workers, such as yourself, fall under this umbrella.
Yeah, it's a huge sector. I was looking at a stat from the Nonprofit Center from Northeast Florida, and there's 58,000 employees just in Duval alone in the nonprofit sector, and they bring in almost $7 billion a year. So it's a huge sector. Then we're covering the environment. We're covering human services. So we do a lot of work in an area that the government sector is either not going fast enough or unable to cover.
Yeah, can't fill all those gaps. There aren't always enough tax dollars available. And riverkeeper organizations like yours, Neil, do such important work. The St. John's Riverkeeper, the Matanzas Riverkeeper. There are people like you in cities all over this country protecting our waterways.
Right. There are, I think, seven keepers now in Florida. And I've always felt if you're looking after the environment, the water, the lands, the air, that is the ultimate public service because all of us benefit from the work that we do.
Tell us a little bit about your work because people enjoy going out and seeing the river, but they might not realize that someone like you is there to protect it and keep it healthy.
Well, you know, river keepers, water keepers, our job is to focus on a body of water that's important to our community. The Matanzas is one of the last healthy rivers in Florida, and it's one of the most culturally important aspects of St. Augustine. The reason St. Augustine is there, the nation's oldest city, as they like to say, is because of the Matanzas. And, you know, organizations like Sarah and mine, without public assistance, meaning people who help us do our work, so they also are part of this whole public service model, if you will.
And let's share a little bit about your mission as well. The Northeast Florida chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. Green building, part of the overall objective of sustainability, has really taken off.
Yeah, well, it's a better product. We're learning that we can have healthy, high-performing buildings at no extra cost. And most people don't realize that buildings have used 60% of the energy in the United States and cause 40% of the emissions. So we're this huge impact, and we spend 90% of our time indoors. And we're just not switching to the better green building product fast enough in our mind because we could put a lot of people to jobs, save a lot of energy, save a lot of water, a lot of human health. So we're trying to nudge that needle farther, faster in the nonprofit sector.
And how do you go about doing that? And what are some ways that the building sector could adopt more of these practices?
So we are in three areas. We're in education awareness, education, building up kind of awareness from the community, and then kind of policy area, nudging the market. So we do a lot of education of building owners, developers, residential, how they can make their buildings higher performing and healthier. The awareness part is getting out in the community and doing a lot of lectures. And then the policy part is, for instance, we have like a greening the multiple listing service. So did you know on the 8.5 by 11 sheet, there's no, usually don't list the green features of a home, whether it has low, whether it has solar or low utility bills or native planning or whatever. So, but if 75 or 72% of Americans, if they see the green features and everything else is equal, like same square footage, et cetera, they're going to choose the one that has more green features. They lean that way naturally. It makes more sense. It makes good pocketbook sense. So that's where we're trying to create the environment, set the environment to, so that people can make smart choices.
And earlier in the hour, Neil, we were talking with the CEO of Visit Jax about how this area is an ecotourism hub.
Right.
You're engaged in public service, but there's also money to be made in making this area beautiful and outdoor, especially our waterways.
Right. I mean, I think that I hope we're beyond the point of environmental protection is a drag on the economy. It's just the opposite. And, you know, when you are working to protect something that's important to the community, both economically and culturally, again, I think that is something that we all strive for.
Absolutely. Well, it is Public Service Recognition Week, a time to honor the nation's public servants. We are talking to public servants of all stripes every day this week on the program. So thank you both for stopping by and sharing a little bit about your mission. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your public service, Melissa.
WJCT is engaged in public service as well. So that is absolutely true. And we were joined by Sarah Boren, the local chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council, and Neil Armanjian. He is the Matanzas Riverkeeper. Well, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now. Video on demand segments with our partners TVJax.com and MetroJacksonville.com. Next on Diane Rehm, since 2005, nearly 800 reporters have been killed while doing their work. The risks reporters face around the world and new efforts to boost press safety and freedoms, that's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.